We've seen quite a few times in Isaiah how much emphasis God puts on prophecy as a proof of God, and how many times he chides the idols and pokes fun at them being powerless and not having any supernatural power. So we'll run into that a little bit more here before we get into the millennial chapters that end the book. He starts off with an abbreviated form of the word Baal. Baal bows down, Nebo stoops. So these are just a couple of the gods that are going to be exposed and brought down to nothing. So in order to protect their gods, they loaded them up on their animals and fled out with their gods on their animals to protect them from the invading enemy. Seems kind of weird, like anybody'd know that can't be a god if you have to load him on a wagon or on the back of a horse and flee out with him to keep him from getting smashed into bits. But here these idols are loaded on the beasts and on the cattle and carriages all loaded down with idols and a burden even to a weary beast. So here are these animals just bending over trying to pull these weighty statues of stone and rock. They stoop, they bow down together, they couldn't deliver the burden. But their own souls are gone into captivity. So even these gods weren't able to deliver people that trusted in them, but even their gods ended up going into captivity. A lot of cases made out of gold and silver and precious valuables. And then God wants Israel to think about what's happened to the gods of the heathen and the heathen nations. So he says, "Hearken to me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel." One note I read that I haven't had time to check out yet, and maybe you'll have the time, some of you, to check it out, but in the Companion Bible, they suggest that when it talks about house of Israel, it's talking more about their spiritual reward as the new name God gave the man. And when it talks about the house of Jacob, it's talking more about their humanity, their physical accomplishments and physical reward. So I don't know whether, I haven't checked that out enough to tell. I know in the New Testament, when it uses the name Jesus, it's talking more about the individual as a person, and when it uses the name Christ, it's talking about the anointed or the Messiah. So that may well be true here. I know God changed a few people's names, and there's a lot of significance to that, but I haven't had a chance to check that out any further. Hearken to me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel, which are born by me. So now God kind of contrasts how these animals and carts carried pagan gods, and then those gods themselves couldn't deliver the people that trusted in them and went into captivity. And God is saying, now look what I've done for you. I've been bearing you about. You don't carry me about as your God. I'm your God. I carry you about. You've been born by me from the belly, which you're carried from the womb. In other words, from birth, I've carried you, protected you, led you, sheltered you, provided for you. So he's showing what a real God is compared to ridiculous ideas humans have about gods. You know, when the Russians say that man has created gods by the thousands, that's really true. But not the true God, not the creator God. But man does create gods. But here God says, you're born by me from the belly, which you're carried from the womb. And even to your old age I am he. Even to hoar hairs I'll carry you. I've made and I'll bear you. I'll carry and I'll deliver you. I won't let you go into captivity like these heathen idols do their people that trust in them. So here again God shows his power as the creator. I've made you. I've been the one to bear you about, to carry you. So now he says, to whom will you liken me and make me equal and compare me that we may be like? You know, if you drive across the country and look out and see the part of creation that's still not destroyed by man, then it's hard to find anything to liken God to. You know, we hear the song about only God can make a tree and the clouds and the sunsets and things like that. I was driving into Phoenix last night about sundown, and I thought, boy, oh boy, look at the beautiful sky and the mountains sticking up. And you think, well, what can you compare God to? Because he's created all those great things. To whom will you liken me and make me equal and compare me? But man goes out, he lavishes gold out of the bag, weighs silver in the balance, hires the goldsmith, and he makes it a god. And they fall down, yea, they worship. They bear him on the shoulder and carry him and set him in his place, and he stands. From his place shall he not remove. Yea, one shall cry unto him, yet can he not answer, nor save him out of his trouble. So God reminds his people, remember this. Show yourselves men. Don't be ignorant enough to worship dumb statues and created things like rivers and mountains and the moon and the sun and the stars and the heavenly bodies. Remember this. Show yourselves men. Bring it again to mind. Think about it again. Oh, you transgressors. Remember the former things of old. I'm God. There's none else. I'm God. There's none like me. And here again, he shows how a proof of God is being able to foretell prophecy and have it come to pass. And you know, prophecy that even hasn't come to pass yet is another proof of God, because a lot of us have known of prophecy for 10, 20, 25, 28 years, and it's happening every day. So you might say not only fulfilled prophecy is the proof of God, but progressive fulfilling of prophecy. So God can declare the end from the beginning. Jeannie Dixon guesses about 53% right, even with the help of demons. But God declares from the end from the beginning. God declares from ancient times the things that are not yet done. God says, my counsel shall stand, and I'll do all my pleasure. God could call a ravenous bird from the east, like Osiris or Nebuchadnezzar, beast or false prophet. The man that would execute God's counsel, God can bring him like a ravenous bird from a far country. Yea, I've spoken it, I'll also bring it to pass. I've purposed it, I'll also do it. Hearken to me, you hard-headed or obstinate. There he's not talking about stout-hearted men in a positive way, but in a flint, stubborn, pig-headed way. Hearken to me, you hard-heads that are far from righteousness. In other words, people that don't have any fear of God or won't take any warning about trouble that's coming from a lack of righteousness. I'll bring my righteousness. It'll be not far off, and my salvation shall not tarry. I'll place salvation in Zion for Israel, my glory. So he always ends on a positive note, as most, well, all prophecy books do, really. But here he ends up talking about the millennium, when salvation is going to be going out from Zion. In a lot of cases, the term Zion is talking more about the church even than it is Mount Zion, where the temple stood on Mount Moriah there. And so now he talks about the great pagan empires that man tends to idolize. You know, people probably talk more about the old Roman Empire than they do any other one in history. The glory of Rome, you know, the great movies about Rome and the eternal city. And three coins in the fountain, you know. And everything's Rome, the great, great Rome. But in the Bible, God always talks about her breaking in pieces, trampling underfoot, destroying. And yet, man doesn't see it the way God sees it. So now God pronounces the ultimate on the old Babylonian system in total, and especially in that day of Nebuchadnezzar's Babylonian Empire and its fall, but especially in our day of the coming United States of Europe and its downfall. A lot of the book of Revelation is actually quoted out of this part of Isaiah. It must be the Apostle Paul must have really enjoyed 2nd Isaiah, as they call him, because you find a lot of Isaiah quoted in Romans in a lot of Paul's writings. You know, having been a Baptist, it was kind of interesting to me that the book the Baptists used to do away with the Old Testament quotes more out of it than any other book. That's kind of odd, isn't it? The book of Romans has more quotes out of the Old Testament in it than any other book in the New Testament. And yet it's the one they used to do away with the Old Testament. So that's really kind of ridiculous. He surely wouldn't have quoted so much out of it if he's going to do away with it. Well, now he starts talking about the end result. Come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. And of course here he's saying that kind of in a sarcastic way, that she claims to be God's church. She claims to be the virgin woman of the Bible, and yet she's not God's church at all. They just took the pagan practices and branded them Christian, and so God is chiding her in that way. They're going to be brought down. They're going to sit in the dust like people do when they're total repentant in sackcloth and ashes. Come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground. There's no throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans. You know, some critics kind of take delight in bringing up the term Chaldeans. And they say, well, you know, how can they use the term Chaldean and the term Babylon jointly? And really, the Chaldean term is more the religious system and the leaders of Babylon, and the Babylon is more just the masses of people. So it's really more accurate than you might think just on the surface. So here he not only talks about the daughter of the Chaldeans living delicately, living so tenderly, and now instead of being so delicate and tender, they're going to have to do the work of slaves. Take the millstones and grind meal. Instead of going around with all the rich decorations on, uncover your locks, make bare the leg, uncover the thigh. In other words, get ready to work. You're not just for looks. You're not just there for a decoration on the mantelpiece. You're there for a practical purpose. So here's this delicate society, highbrow woman that's so used to everything so tender and delicate, and now all of a sudden doing the work of slaves. And that's literally going to happen to the nations of Israel. You know, many prophecies talk about the same terminology, tender and delicate, among the people of Israel, and how they're going to have to go through some rough times to get back to reality. That they live so delicately and tenderly and don't really know what hard work is. So all of a sudden, taking the millstones and grinding meal and putting on garments that are suitable for work instead of just looks, girding the loins, getting ready to run and work, cross the rivers, your nakedness shall be uncovered, yea, your shame shall be seen. I'll take vengeance. And no man is going to interfere to stop it. It's rather poorly translated there in the last part of that verse. So God is going to take vengeance on the Babylonian system and not man. That again shows that it's talking about the end time when Christ returns and not in any past time when Media Persians were used by God to punish. But this time God is going to take the vengeance. And no man is going to stop God from intervening until he's totally exposed the shame and nakedness of the old Babylonian system. So people aren't going to idolize it anymore and worship it and think it's so great. You know, if you've ever visited Pompeii and seen some of the pictures on the walls of some of the wretchedness that was going on back at that day, it's kind of like our country is getting today. All the immorality and lewdness and wretchedness, marrying and all kinds of things and drink and sex and just materialism. Well, then he goes again with the contrast back to the Savior and Redeemer and the God of Israel. As for our Redeemer, the Eternal Host is his name, the Holy One of Israel. Another title we've seen in the past, numerically significant in Isaiah. So now all of a sudden, though, sit you silent and get you into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans. So here, sitting silently, nothing to say. All of a sudden, stunned and humbled and brought down to silence, going into the misery and darkness of captivity. You will no more be called the mistress of the kingdoms, the eternal city, the lady of kingdoms, the great Roman Empire. Outlasted all the others in length as iron. And then God begins to show, he said, I was wroth with my people. I polluted mine inheritance. I gave them into your hand. And yet, what did you do? Here, I was delivering them into your hands because of their immorality and their wretchedness. And what did you do? You turned right around and became just as wretched and immoral as they were. You showed them no mercy. Even on the very elderly, you very heavily laid your yoke. So the yoke of the great tribulation, you'll find that term used quite often about the great tribulation coming on Israel, the yoke of the Babylonians. And it isn't going to make any difference about age or about being women or virgins or what. You said, I'll be a lady forever. So she claims herself the eternal city, the eternal church, you know, the church that's going to live forever, the woman that's going to live forever. So that you did not lay these things to your heart, you wouldn't believe you weren't going to last forever. People tried to tell you that you weren't really the true church and you weren't really going to save the world and save man and make all the earth Christian, but they're going to be promising everybody that they're going to turn all the heathen and everybody into Christians, and only Christians will be left. So you didn't lay these things to your heart, neither did you remember the latter end of it. Therefore, hear now this, you that are given to pleasures, that dwell carelessly, or confidently, or just securely. You say in your heart, I am. Boy, that's a frightening thing. They begin to take God's name. I am. That's God's name. Nobody else can say that. Well, that's no surprise. You know, they take the name Holy Reverend and Father and Holy Father and Papa and everything else, you know. Well, all of a sudden, that's going to end. But there's this haughty, highfalutin attitude at the end. They're sure they're going to bring the world the millennium. They're God's church and God's people, and they're going to establish Catholicism, finally conquering the world with their great Roman Catholicism. You're saying in your heart, I am, and there's none else beside me. But you notice that's what God said in the previous chapter. I am God, and there's none else. Verse 9, I'm God, there's none like me. So they're taking titles of God. I'll not sit as a widow, which is a term used as a king who'd lost his life and left his wife as there alone, so she was going to have a king. She wasn't going to sit without a king. She wasn't going to know the loss of children being depopulated by captivity. So when they were warned that they were going to go into the captivity and they were going to lose their false prophet and the beast, they weren't going to listen to that. They didn't believe that. They said, no. They had this haughty security. I'm not going to sit as a widow. I'm not going to know the loss of children. But the prophet said, both of those are going to happen to you in a moment. In one day. Boy, that's going to come quickly, you know, when Armageddon hits and when Christ intervenes with the seventh trumpet. Boy, that's going to happen quickly, in one day. This old Babylonian system is going to lose children and become a widow. These both are going to come on you. In their totality, in their fullness, because of the multitude of your sorceries. Now notice terms here that are used again and again in Revelation. Your merchants, in verse 15, here he talks about your sorceries. All of those were referred to back in the book of Revelation. For the great abundance of your enchantments. So apparently it's going to be an empire that's going to claim a lot of supernatural miracles and inspiration and statues bleeding and weeping and a multitude of enchantments. I don't know if the Baptists ever had any of those. They hadn't had any of that at all, you know. No multitude of them. You've trusted in your wickedness. In other words, they became so tyrannical and so militaristic and so destructive, as God likened them in the Daniel. The iron that smashes all the others and breaks in pieces and consumes. So that's what they trusted in. The other nations were terrified of them. They trusted in their ferocious fierceness. They wouldn't restrain from doing anything. You said, none sees me. Your wisdom and your knowledge. So here again, the so-called Roman law and the so-called wisdom of the Romans that came down through the Greeks and the Persians and all. Your wisdom and your knowledge, it's perverted you. It's caused you to turn away. You said in your heart, I am. There's none else beside me. What a contrast when you read chapter 46, what God said, and then chapter 47, what she says. Therefore, evil's going to come on you. And you're not going to know from whence it rises. It's going to come so quickly, coming from God. They're not going to look for it from the heavens. They thought God was with them in all of it. Mischief is going to fall on you. You're not going to be able to escape it. Desolation is going to come on you suddenly that you're not going to know. God's going to pour out the seven last plagues, and they're coming supernaturally, invisibly from God and the angels. So they didn't expect that. They thought they'd finally just about taken over the whole world when they defeated Israel and were getting ready to finish off those heathen. And then all of a sudden, look what happens. The seventh trump sound, and God pours out his plagues, and boy, desolation comes on Babylon suddenly. Stand now with your enchantments, with the multitude of your sorceries, wherein you've labored from your youth. So from the very birth of the Babylonian system, they practiced these enchantments and sorceries. They were full of the Babylonian mystery priests and all the spiritism. If so be, you'll be able to profit. If so be, you may prevail. Call out all your gods. You know, all, let out all the stops. This is it. Get all of your spiritualists together and all of your gods together. You're wearied in the multitude of your counsels. Let not now the astrologers, the stargazers, the monthly prognosticators, those were people that used the moons as means of foretelling horoscopes, and stand up and save you from these things that'll come on you. Behold, they'll be as stubble. So here he's talking about their gods he referred to in chapter 45. They're just created things, heavenly bodies that they go by, and the examining of animals' entrails when the little baby's born to forecast what it's going to happen in its life. Man, isn't that weird? To see what the heavenly signs are at the time of your birth, you know, and they're going to be a stubble. The fire's going to burn them. They're not going to deliver their own souls even. The word themselves is the word nephesh there. But they wouldn't want you to know that, you know. That might make you wonder about what a soul is. Even these idols are referred to as souls. Even these spiritualists, these astrologers and stargazers are referred to as souls. Behold, they'll be a stubble. The fire will burn them. So here it's talking about souls that are going to be like stubble that fire will burn. And it really, the word burn means burn them up. It doesn't mean just burn them and burn them and burn them. They'll not deliver their souls from the power of the flame. So that's another real good verse for hell. You know, just write hell right across the verse there. I've got it written across a lot of verses in the Bible. But I know what hell is, you know. It's a place where fire burns up souls. It's not a place where fire tortures souls forever and ever. So here are souls that are trying to deliver themselves from God that fire is going to burn. The fire of God in the seventh trumpet when he pours out that fire and brimstone like he did on Sodom and Gomorrah. And none of these gods or any of these things will be able to deliver their souls from the power of the flame. There'll not be a coal to warm at, nor a fire to sit before it. That's how much totally it burns it up. That's a real good picture of hell there. Thus shall they be to you with whom you've labored, even your merchants. That just ties right back into Revelation 18. It talks about the merchants and all the multitude of merchandising and the power of the beast being trade wars and built up by finance. They shall wander everyone to his quarter, and none shall save you. Hear you this, O house of Jacob, which are called by the name of Israel, and are come forth out of the waters of Judah. In other words, they all originated over in the Middle East, where the peoples of Judah, you know, waters are masses of people. So all he's saying here is that Jacob originated there and came out from among those waters of Judah, and they're still there. So that shows they're not one and the same. Jacob and Israel came out of there. They left there. They went somewhere else. But the waters of Judah were still there. They stayed there. They didn't go anywhere. So now he says, you swear by the name of the Eternal, and you make mention of the God of Israel, but not in truth. No, in Christmas, you know. You saw all those signs put Christ back in Christmas. Well, that's hard to do. He never was in it. But they're all always trying to put Christian names on all this paganism. So God plainly says here that it isn't any question they have the same Bible and the same God. They swear by his name and mention the God of Israel. and yet not in righteousness. The law is done away with. Do as you please. License. Permissivism. Not in truth, in paganism. In creeds of men and creeds of churches. For they call themselves of the holy city and stay themselves upon the God of Israel. Now really the term, when it talks about the holy city, that always kind of struck me as being odd that we would refer to a place as corrupt as Jerusalem and call it the holy city. And it really doesn't mean in the Bible terminology the holy city in that sense. But it means the city of God's sanctuary, which is really, unless God is there, it isn't holy. If the old temple and the old house of God is there, then that's different. It's a holy place for a temple, but it's not a holy city. And even the Hebrew doesn't say that. It doesn't. That's a poor translation. It isn't really translated that way, the holy city. It means the city of the sanctuary, the literal Hebrew terminology. But notice how proud people were in Jesus' day of being Jerusalemites. Oh, if you were a Jerusalemite, you were just the upper crust, you know. That was, nobody could be any higher, I guess, unless they were a priest, than the Jerusalemite. And you'd be surprised reading in the Jewish Talmud how much of your sin is forgiven just for living in Jerusalem. And a little bit less than if you just live out in the country, you know, if you're a hillbilly in the sticks, then you don't quite have that same sanctity of a Jerusalemite. So you might notice that when you read through the New Testament, how proud they were of being Jerusalemites. And really, when God rewards the Philadelphian in the book of Revelation, he said, you know, we'll be Jerusalemites. We'll dwell at the center of God's capital. So in this way, in a human way, they call themselves of the holy city and stay themselves. They're confident and sure and trusty, and they just have this air of confidence and assurance. They stay themselves upon the God of Israel. The Eternal Host is his name. I've declared the former things from the beginning. I told about Israel being in Egypt four generations and then coming out in a great miracles. I've declared the former things from the beginning. And God has done that all the way through the Bible. You know, parts you might not even think of as prophecy. Now, Moses was a prophet. A lot of the men in the Old Testament, you know, you read Genesis, the last chapter, Jacob was a prophet, foretold what would happen to all those tribes in the last days. And so when God says, I've declared the former things from the beginning, they went forth out of my mouth, and I showed them. I did them suddenly, and they came to pass. So a lot of things God foretells, at the time they're foretold, it seemed just the opposite. You know, right when Babylon was rising to the peak of its power, God had Daniel write all about its downfall. Nobody else was foretelling any downfall. People wait till it's obvious there's a downfall coming, and then they foretell it. That's not any big deal. But God declares the former things from the beginning. And all of a sudden they happen. You may have known about it for a long time, then bang, all of a sudden, just what he said happened. And they came to pass. Because I knew that you're obstinate, hard-headed, stubborn, and your neck is an iron sinew and your brow brass. Why anybody would want to be an Israelite? That's hard for me to figure out. You know, Mr. Manteuffel used to always kid us. He said, no, my name is Mac Manteuffel. That'd make him an Israelite. He didn't like his name because it was a German name that meant man-devil. But, you know, everybody wanted to be an Israelite. I don't know why everybody wants to be an Israelite. You know, I'm glad to live in America, and I wouldn't want to live in a lot of other countries. You know, I wouldn't mind living in Switzerland, but that's Israel too. And I wouldn't mind living in England, but that's Israel. And I sure wouldn't want to live in Mexico. You know, just drive past that in El Paso, and that cures you in a hurry, you know. Wanting to be born down there, live down there. But as far as human nature, you know, if you're only speaking materially, I can see why everybody would want to be an Israelite. But if you're speaking about your nature, you know, we had a lot of the Spanish men in on the refresher program this class, and boy, I in a lot of ways, I'd like to be like they are, you know.
Beauty about their nature that just really, I enjoy it. You know, a lot of times I wish I were fourth French and a fourth German and part Irish and part Welsh and part... You know, if you were just purebred, you'd have a lot less trouble with character with yourself. When you got four different parts of you pulling all directions, that... But when I read the Bible, I wonder why people want to be Israelites. Can you imagine that? Oh, God, I sure wish I could be obstinate, and my neck an iron sinew, and my brow brass.
Well, if you're speaking about it materially, that's understandable. He goes on, I have even from the beginning declared it to you. Before it came to pass, I showed it to you, lest you should say, mine idol has done them, and my graven image and my molten image has commanded them. No, they never did foretell anything and make it happen. You have heard, see all this. Will not you admit it's indeed so? Repeat it? Admit it. I've showed you new things from this time, even hidden things that you didn't know them. They're created now and not from the beginning. So he's always showing more, you know. It wasn't just that he foretold prophecy at once and then he quit. That isn't true at all. They're created now and not from the beginning, even before the day when you heard them not, lest you should say, behold, I knew them, I already knew that. So God knows you pretty well when you read that. Yea, you heard not. Yea, you didn't know. Yea, from the time that your ear was not open, you didn't know. I knew that you'd deal very treacherously and you were called a transgressor from birth. I didn't even get you out of Egypt. You weren't even born as a nation before you were corrupting already. Gone into transgression. Brought some idols out of Egypt with you and some of their ideas. And so you weren't even planted to give birth as a nation before you were already transgressing from the birth. For my name's sake, though, I have to defer mine anger. And for my praise, I've got to refrain for you, and I can't cut you off. Behold, I've refined you, but not like purifying silver. I've chosen you in the furnace of affliction. So here he's showing again how the impurities of an impure nation had to be melted away by tribulation and troubles. For mine own sake, even for mine own sake, I'll do it. For how should my name be polluted? Since he's the true God and the only God and the living God and the all-powerful God, how could he not do what he's foretold? He's got to do it. He has to do it. Well, you know, here a while back we had some guys that were trying to, they thought they'd run into something new. Back here in Paul's writings it said, whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. Oh, hey! So they gave these great messages, you know, about prophecies failing. Well, they're not going to do it. You know, that isn't what that means. Whether there were prophecies, what about ones that were already fulfilled? That's what that means. It doesn't mean any prophecies are going to fail. You know, God said he can cut short the time of the great tribulation, but to my knowledge, that's all he reserves the right to change. And I can tell you for sure, you know, if 10 nations don't unite in Europe and form a beast power ridden over by the great false church, and end up taking Israel captive, you know, then you can just throw your Bible away and forget about it and not worry about it. But don't let anybody kid you, there are going to be prophecies that are going to fail. You know, what would that do if you started believing that? Then every time you'd read a prophecy, you'd say, well, maybe that's one of those that's going to fail. So you'd get where you didn't believe any of it, you know. We've had some stupid comments made in the last years. We've had one comment made that, you can't legislate character. And that just never did settle in my brain. I never could accept that, you know. I never did hear Mr. Herbert Armstrong say that. And all the time I was in college, that's what he was doing, legislating character. You know, we had prohibition slapped on one year because some guys couldn't have the character to handle alcohol properly. I mean, he legislated character, boy, I'll tell you for sure. You can legislate character. What do you do for your kids until they're old enough to have some character? You legislate character all the time. Now, we've really had some funny comments made. No, there aren't any prophecies going to fail. God says, for mine own sake, for mine own name's sake, I've got to do what I said I'm going to do. Why, how should my name be polluted? Yeah, think that big eternal God there said such and so, and it didn't happen. He said he was going to bring those people to the promised land, and then he slaughtered them all in the wilderness. You know, God can't do that. How should my name be polluted? I'll not give my glory to another. Hearken to me, O Jacob, and Israel my call. And you know, it does seem every time you see both terms Jacob and Israel used together, Israel's always the spiritual terminology of God's call or God's renamed man that was converted and different than the old human Jacob. I am he. I am the first. I also am the last. I'm Alpha and Omega. I'm the beginning and the end. I can tell things ahead and bring things to an end. My hand has also laid the foundation of the earth. My right hand has spanned the heavens. So that wasn't guesswork, you know. God measured it all out just exactly. And you can't change any of that. You know, God put the laws in the heavens and named all the different bodies that he created out there and put them in their positions to one another. God says, my hand, my right hand, spanned out the heavens. When I call to them, they stand up together. In other words, my laws, you can set all your man-made mechanical things by them. They are perfect in their cycling, in their movements. All you, assemble yourselves and hear. Which among these false gods has been able to declare these kind of things? Now he begins to talk again about his ability to bring a man like Cyrus in and punish people like the Babylonians. And the Eternal has loved him. He will do his pleasure on Babylon, and his arm shall be on the Chaldeans. That's referring to what Christ is going to do to the Babylonians in the future as well. But in a sense, Cyrus was the man back in that day that God loved and caused to do his pleasure on Babylon. I've spoken. Yea, I've called him. I've brought him. He'll make his way prosperous. So God was in it, directing it. Come you near unto me. Hear you this. I've not spoken in secret from the beginning, from the time that the decree against Babylon was. There I was, and now the Lord Eternal and His Spirit has sent me. Thus says the Eternal, your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, I am the Eternal, your God, that teaches you to profit. Boy, you could go back to Deuteronomy and quote laws by the score that fulfill that statement. Teaches you to profit. Just follow all those laws and you have happiness and profit and success, which leads you by the way that you should go. Oh, that you'd hearken to my commandments. Boy, Satan wasn't smart when he got all Christianity thinking law is done away with. That has to be the key thing he did, you know. Now, don't read that Deuteronomy. Don't read that Exodus and Leviticus. Don't follow any of those laws. And yet that's how God teaches us to profit. That's how God leads us by the way that we should go. Oh, that you had hearkened to my commandments. They'd bring you peace. Then you'd had peace like a quiet, smooth, clear, pure river. Then your righteousness would be like the waves of the sea, just continuous and unfailing and perpetual. So here again, you notice what righteousness is, all of God's commandments. Your seed also had been as the sand, and the offspring of your bowels like the gravel thereof. The name wouldn't have been cut off nor destroyed from before me. So God honors ones that do go God's way perpetually, even with their children, as he did with David and as he did with Ishmael, even for Abraham's sake. Go you forth of Babylon. So now here you read again, just like back in the book of Revelation, come out of her, my people, that you don't be partakers of her plagues. So now God says the same thing here. Go you forth out of Babylon, flee you from the Chaldeans, with a voice of singing declare you. Tell this, utter it even to the end of the earth. Say you, the Eternal has redeemed his servant Jacob. Now notice where all Israel is scattered at the time God brings them out of Babylon. Babylon is a worldwide power. They're brought from the end of the earth. And this fact that God has redeemed his servant Jacob is declared to the end of the earth. A voice of singing. They didn't thirst when he led them through the deserts. He caused the waters to flow out of the rock for them. So those miracles we're going to all live through again in the future. You know, the miracles of the old Exodus, we relive them every spring at Passover time, but boy, to have them happen. You know, God's going to cause a river to come out of rocks over in a place of safety. And we're not going to thirst even when we're led through deserts. God is going to cleave the rock just like He did back there, and the waters are going to gush out. There's no peace, says the Eternal, of the wicked. Listen, O isles, our maritime countries or coastlands. Now that refers to places like Greece and Turkey, and it may in some cases refer just specifically to Israel. And it may here, because notice in verse 3, you are my servant, O Israel. So he may be specifically referring here to the maritime coastlands that are Israel and not to the coastlands of the whole world. So maybe here he's talking about England and Denmark and Norway and Sweden and countries like that. Listen, O coastlands, to me, and hearken, you people from far. The Eternal has called me from birth, from the bowels of my mother. He's made mention of my name. And most Bibles have the little P with a circle around it, showing they understand that to refer to Christ. And some try to just say, no, that's just talking about Cyrus. Well, if you're a Jew, you don't want it referring to Christ, so you just pass it off as being Cyrus. The only trouble, you can't read very much further and still be true to that interpretation. So notice as you read on down, the Eternal has called me from birth. So God named Cyrus 150 years before he was ever born even. From the bowels of my mother he's made mention of my name, even called him by name. He has made my mouth like a sharp sword. In the shadow of his hand has he hid me, and made me a sharpened spear, and his quiver has he hid me. And said to me, you're my servant, O Israel. Uh-oh. Well, that takes care of the Cyrus part, doesn't it? No, he's talking about Israel, that God called from before they were born even. God loved Jacob and not Esau before they were born. And God made Israel's mouth like a sharp sword. You're my servant, O Israel, in whom I'll be glorified. Then I said, I've labored in vain. I've spent my strength for naught. That's your truth. What have we got to show for the promised land God brought us to? Well, what have we done with it? So once we look back over it, then we'll be saying, well, boy, we labored in vain. We spent our strength for paganism. Yea, surely my judgment is with the Eternal and my work with my God. So finally Israel's going to wake up and realize that, who they were. So here, always in the Bible, you see that the people of Israel didn't know who they were. They wandered years not even knowing who they were. And even when they were brought to the promised land, they didn't know who they were. And now, says the Eternal that formed me from the womb to be his servant, to bring Jacob again to him. Uh-oh, that even makes it more complicated now. Because if Jacob is the servant, then how is Jacob the servant going to bring Jacob the servant again to him? So here he's talking about Christ as an Israelite, and they're right when they have that P with a circle on it there. It is talking about Christ. But it could be talking about Israel as well. But primarily now he's zeroing in on Christ. The Eternal formed from birth Christ to be his servant to bring Jacob again to him. Though Israel be not gathered, yet shall I be glorious in the eyes of the Eternal, and my God shall be my strength. So here in the future, ultimately, Israel is going to be brought and gathered by Christ at the seventh trump and brought back to their country again. He said, it's a light thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved of Israel. So notice at the time when Christ at that seventh trumpet regathers Israel, tribes, plural. They're not all molded into one. They're not all Jews. They're not all just one country. We read they were scattered to the ends of the earth. You wouldn't do that with one country being taken over by the Arabs surrounding it. Here he's talking about Israel being gathered from the corners of the earth. And he's talking about tribes. And when Christ regathers them, they're going to be raised up. They're going to be restored. I'll also give you for a light to the Gentiles, that you may be my salvation unto the end of the earth. So now you know it's talking about Christ, although as you started off, you didn't really know for sure which one it was talking about. So it shows you how you have to just keep reading until you get the whole story together, and then it's clear. So now Christ is also going to be a light to the Gentiles. He's going to be his salvation to the ends of the earth. Thus says the Eternal, the Redeemer of Israel, and his Holy One, to him whom... Now here the word man is nephesh. Soul. So here is a soul that despises the Redeemer, the Holy One. Now, what soul is going to despise the Messiah, the Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel? Well, of course, Satan does, and the false prophet's going to. To him whom the nations abhors, so even the nations are going to be angry, and they're going to fight Christ at his coming. They're not going to believe that it's really the Messiah returning back to the earth. So even the nations, it should be plural there, the Hebrew word is nations, plural, not nation, to a servant of rulers, kings are going to see Israel's ascent to greatness, and they're going to rise in respect to the Messiah later, but at first they're going to fight him, they're going to abhor him. One soul's even going to despise him. But then that's going to be turned into rising in respect and worship, because of the Eternal that's faithful. Now, only when Israel is made spirit beings can they be worshipped. So here again, it's proof that they're born as sons of God. You know, one of the men on the refresher program, when he took the tour of our house over there, that some of them said, well, you ought to just name that a museum and move somewhere else. But you know, he saw some of the old literature, and we had a real old, must have been 1940, 41, or 42, plain truth, and the lead article he was reading. And as he read it, he said, well, you know, it doesn't sound like Mr. Armstrong knew then that we're going to be God. We're going to be sons of God, literally gods in the God family. And that's right. He was afraid to believe that. I asked him about that, and he said, well, I couldn't help but have to admit that's what it seemed to say in there, but I'm just afraid to let myself really believe that it really said that. But that article showed that at that time he didn't believe that. He didn't quite, couldn't see how you could say that. But he felt, I guess, like everybody else, well, that's blasphemy to say we're going to be God. Well, we're going to be sons of God. We're going to be in the God family. And what does that make you then? Now, when you say we're going to be God, right away people think you mean instead of God or above God or... So you have to explain it pretty quick. Say, now, wait a minute, I didn't say I was going to become the God, or I was going to be the only God or above God. I just meant I'm going to be in the God family. Oh, well, that's all right. And they can swallow that, but say you're going to be God, they're liable to think you ought to have a white jacket on in a mental institution. Well, anyway, back to the text again. So finally, kings are going to see and rise in respect and worship because of the Eternal that's faithful and the Holy One of Israel. And he's going to choose you, Israel, and put you right back where he intended to. Thus says the Eternal, and here's this oft-misquoted scripture back in 2 Corinthians, and even the Companion Bible says, quoted in, and I just put misquoted in, because it's not quoted, it's misquoted. They jumped the gun on it and put a little Martin Luther twist on it. In an acceptable time. Now, if you read that in the New Testament, it says, in the acceptable time. So they want you to believe there's only one day of salvation. And boy, they hinge a lot of that on this scripture. But that isn't what it says. It says, in an acceptable time, have I heard you, Israel? And in the day of salvation, I'm going to help you, Israel. I'm going to preserve you and give you for a covenant. And here again, the covenant people, British term that we ran across earlier, only twice in the Bible. So here, at the time when God is talking about Israel being made to be worshipped, being made God, being made a leader of the world, he's talking about British, the covenant people. I'm going to make you the covenant people to establish the earth, to cause, to inherit the desolate heritages. So that's what Israel is going to be doing through the millennium. They're going to be in a position of directing people into inheriting the desolate heritages. Well, how long do you think it's going to take us to turn those deserts into fertile countries? Well, they've done that with Arizona, New Mexico. You know, a lot of that area, they've underground water, irrigated, and they've turned barren, waste, desolate deserts into some beautiful farmland. But it's taken several decades to do it. And, you know, God isn't going to wave a magic wand and all of a sudden, in 10 years in the millennium, we'll have 990 years to live in paradise. Boy, I hope you don't think that you're going to be in for a surprise. You know, I used to wonder, especially when my dad died, and I thought, well, why would God make us wait 1,000 years before we get to see all those dead relatives we want to see? Boy, why does it have to be 1,000 years? Sure be nice you just cut off a bunch of that millennium and make it only 100 years, and everybody wouldn't have to wait so long. You know, why make it 100? Why make it 1,000 years? You got eternity after that anyway. So why not just borrow a little bit of that eternity and cut that millennium off short, you know? 1,000 years. There must be a reason it's 1,000 years. You know, we're going to do all of this naturally. We're not going to be just waving magic wands. Well, we're going to go out there and start teaching people how to get rain to come and how to replant trees and how to follow God's laws and let land rest every seventh year. And boy, I'll tell you, it's going to be... How many 50s do you think it's going to take before the land gets rest when it hadn't rested for 6,000 years? Well, I think in the past, when God caused Israel or Judah to be desolate for 70 years, it's because they hadn't let their land rest for 490 years. So every seventh year, that'd be 70 years. So they were off somewhere while that land got caught up on its rest. Well, the millennium's that long for a reason. So Israel is going to cause... That's kind of funny the way that's worded. It's almost like, hey, wait a minute, you're not sending me out there in that desert. Oh, yes, we are. Get on out there. You know, you're going to cause to inherit the desolate heritages. They're already partitioned out for a people. They just don't want to go there. They don't want to stay there. They're already heritages. And Israel is going to cause to inherit those desolate heritages. That you may say to the prisoners, go forth. So all the common people that have been prisoners to their leaders and their military machines are going to be freed from that. So all the way through we've read about saying to those prisoners, go forth out of prison. No longer in your captivity of human nature and ignorance and heathenism. To them that are in darkness, show yourselves. They're going to feed in the ways. Their pastures are going to be in all high places. So God's blessing is going to be back on the earth and rain in due season. And people no longer hide out in captivity of darkness. They'll be able to come right on out and everybody get an heritage and go out and produce. They'll not hunger nor thirst. Neither shall the heat nor sun smite them. Here again, that's quoted in Revelation. He that has mercy on them shall lead them. Even by the springs of water he shall guide them. And I'll make all my mountains away, and my highways shall be exalted. Behold, these shall come from far. Lo, these from the north and from the west, and these from the land of Sinim. The only place that's used in the Bible is probably China. Almost all the sources I've read say that's talking about China. So it's obvious from the way it's worded, he means everybody everywhere. Mongolia, I mean, the deserts of Africa. People are going to come from far and from everywhere, anywhere, and go out and practice God's ways and get the blessings back again. Sing, O heavens, and be joyful, O earth, and break forth into singing, O mountains. You know, when you read that, it sounds like poetic nonsense, but when you get out in the mountains and you see the clouds down on the mountains and you see it, that's very picturesque. The heavens singing. Just floating clouds and beauty of the clouds and the rain and the dark clouds and the wind, and it's like singing. The earth joyful, the wheat rolling and the trees green and the crops and the birds and all the animals, and it's like mountain singing. Wind blowing in the mountains and the trees. And for the Eternal has comforted His people, and He will have mercy upon His afflicted. So it always shows their captivity and then their mercy on them. But Zion said, the Eternal has forsaken me. My Lord has forgotten me. Boy, they didn't think they had much hope after they're in a captivity. After they're out hiding in a captivity. Can a woman forget her sucking child? You can't even use that proverb anymore, can you? Imagine that in the Bible days, that was so unusual and so abnormal. Can a woman forget her sucking child? Boy, yeah, lots of times. Read about it in the paper every day. Women won't even nurse their babies because they don't want to trouble their figure or something. Can a woman forget her sucking child? Well, they didn't used to be able to. But in our day they can. Calloused, hardened, without natural affection. That's a proof we're in the end time. Women give their babies away, have abortions, all kinds of dumping babies in trash cans. But back in that day, that was so rare, you could use that as a proverb. Can a woman forget her sucking child, that she shouldn't have compassion on the son of her womb? Yea, they may forget, yet I'll not forget you. God would never forget them. Now, in contrast to a woman getting hard enough to just get rid of the child from her own body, God says, behold, I have graven you upon the palms of my hands. Like a tattoo, God is engraved right into his hands, Israel. So every time God would look down at his hands, he'd think about Israel he made. Man, he made out of the dust. I've graven you on the palms of my hands. How could I ever forget you? But a woman can forget a child she's given birth to. Your walls are continually before me. Of course, the Jews think that's talking about the wailing wall. It's all that's left of the old temple. Your children shall make haste. Your destroyers and they that made you waste shall go forth of you. Lift up your eyes round about, and behold, all these gather themselves together and come to you. As I live, says the Eternal, you'll surely clothe you with them all. So all these nations that came against Israel, horrifying, frightening, plural nations, God is going to allow Israel to wear them like clothes. They'll put on those countries like garments you wear. As I live, says the Eternal, you shall surely clothe you with all of them as with an ornament and bind them on you as a bride does. So when you think of a bride's apparel, that's just like Israel's going to be with these different nations that make up the power that comes against them. For your waste and your desolate places and the land of your destruction shall even now be too narrow by reason of the inhabitants. And they that swallowed you up shall be far away. The children that which you shall have after you have lost the others shall say again in your ears, the place is too straight for me. Give place to me that I may dwell. So apparently people, when they're in their captivity, are crowded together into such small confines that it's hard to live. Then you'll say in your heart, who has begotten me these? Seeing I've lost my children, I'm desolate, a captive, removing to and fro, who has brought up these? Behold, I was left alone. These, where had they been? Thus says the Lord Eternal, behold, I'll lift up mine hand to the Gentiles, set up my standard to the people. They'll bring your sons in their arms, and your daughters shall be carried upon their shoulders. So when God regathers Israel out of their captivity, he's going to cause all the sons and daughters that have been in a captivity to be brought back by these leaders of these countries where they've been taken captive. Kings shall be your nourishing fathers, not nursing, but nourishing. They'll be the ones that provide you your sustenance and your financial footing for the beginning of the millennium. Their queens, your nourishing mothers. They'll bow down to you with their face toward the earth. So here's when Israel is made into sons of God. Then these leaders that took them captive are going to recognize that they're God's children. They'll bow down to you with their face toward the earth, lick up the dust of your feet. Not literally, but just a token of respect and humility. And you'll know that I am the Eternal. See, that's when they come back to God and they're known to God and they're known by God and they're not lost, not knowing who they are, not knowing God anymore. They'll not be ashamed that wait for me. Shall the prey be taken from the mighty? Or the lawful captive delivered? Yeah, God is going to take the prey that all these Gentiles gather up in their world conquest. And those captives that have been taken captive rightfully, lawfully, they're going to be brought back. But thus says the Eternal, even the captives of the mighty shall be taken away, and the prey of the terrible shall be delivered. So God does entitle those captivities lawful. We deserve them. We earned them. We had it coming. But that doesn't mean God won't forgive and bring them back out of that captivity, because he will. I'll contend with him that contends with you, and I'll save your children.
I'll feed them that oppress you with their own flesh. Well, that's the way it's going to be at Armageddon, you know. It's going to be so straight and so terrifying that God says, I'll feed them that oppress you with their own flesh, and they'll be drunken with their own blood. That's when the blood reaches up to the horses' bridles in Jehoshaphat.
Cannibalism comes back in because of scarcity and long, horrifying war, as with, well, they'll be drunken with their own blood, as with sweet wine. Of course, Protestants like to put that in there. What is sweet wine? Grape juice? No, it isn't. If you look up the Hebrew word here, it means the wine that's just that year's wine. It hasn't been aged at all. It's just the wine of that year. It's not grape juice. There ain't any word wine that's grape juice. Don't let anybody kid you. All flesh shall know that I, the Eternal, am your Savior and your Redeemer. So finally the whole world is going to come to recognize that the God of Israel is the true God. And they were His nations and His peoples. And all flesh shall know that I, the Eternal, am your Savior and your Redeemer, the Mighty One of Jacob.